Minnesota is a state of immigrants. It's been from the beginning. It was European immigrants, Nordic immigrants, many different communities. Now it's, you know, it was the Hmong and the Somali, and there's so many East African immigrants right now as well. And this is a state that needs to accommodate for a lot of diversity that it has.
Welcome to the 373rd installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. As I record this podcast, the issue of immigration in the United States is under a white-hot spotlight. A false narrative is being propagated that the majority of immigrants, particularly those from Central and South America, are here to do harm to our communities. As a result, mass deportations are being threatened, due process is being thrown out the window, and even people here on student visas are literally being snatched off the streets. In short, a kind of war has been declared against immigrants, documented and otherwise. There's no doubt this country is long overdue for major immigration reform. Particularly when it comes to agriculture, the current system is dividing communities and making it so people from other countries are extremely vulnerable to being abused by CAFO owners, meat processors, and other elements of the food and farm system. At the Land Stewardship Project, we center our work around our shared values of stewardship, justice, fairness, democracy, health, and community. The kind of world we're trying to create is one in which all people, no matter their age, race, gender, or immigration status, can live safe and productive lives and contribute to their communities. As a rural organization working toward our mission of promoting an ethic of stewardship for farmland, as well as a sustainable agriculture and healthy communities, it's important that LSP speak up on immigration issues. We depend upon immigrants to contribute to a robust food and agriculture economy in this country. We will not have a sustainable farm and food system until it's sustainable for everyone. That point was reinforced recently when we gathered input from our members and allies while putting together LSP's new long-range plan. That's why LSP is working closely with partners who are on the ground in immigrant communities. In November 2024, more than 90 Minnesota groups formed the Immigrant Defense Network with the aim of protecting the rights of immigrants, empowering immigrant communities, and ensuring accurate information is being circulated in those communities. LSP is a member of IDN and co-facilitates the Greater Minnesota Caucus of the group. A key ally in this work is COPAL, otherwise known as Communities Organizing Latine Power and Action. Created in 2018, COPAL is dedicated to improving the quality of life for Latino people in Minnesota. It focuses on numerous areas, including worker rights, environmental justice, health and wellness, and organizing and leadership. COPAL has offices in Mankato, Minneapolis, and Rochester. And one of its organizing tools is Radio Jornalera, a broadcast station that's part of a network of day labor radio stations in the U.S. and countries in Latin America. I recently went to the Minneapolis office of COPAL to meet with Ryan Perez, the director of organizing for the organization. Ryan is a former LSP staffer and has extensive experience organizing in the Latino community. During our conversation, he talked about the long history of immigration in a state like Minnesota, how the current environment around immigration is impacting COPAL's organizing, and what farmers and other rural residents can do to support their immigrant neighbors. Ryan started our interview describing why a group that works with Latino folks is needed in a state known more for its Scandinavian population base.
COPAL started in 2018 with the goal of improving the quality of life of the Latino community here in Minnesota. I joined in 2019. At the beginning, it was just three or four of us when we were thinking about citizenship classes and how to get people engaged in social change. And the organization has grown just tremendously to be a powerful social movement organization. And now there are teams in Rochester and Mankato, and there's a lot of work happening in southern Minnesota specifically. And the organization does work from health and wellness to campaigns for change to having a worker center and making sure people's rights are respected. And we've been obviously in a really intense moment for the Latino community now, and our organization is stepping up and meeting the need.
You know, one thing that might surprise some people who aren't really paying attention is that there is a need for a nonprofit, an organization like yours, that serves the Latino community in Minnesota. especially if they're not from Minnesota, but even if they are from Minnesota, they might think, well, is there that big of a community here? But there is.
Yeah, that's and I always have this question when we're doing with student groups. I'll say, what percent of Minnesota do you think is Latino? And you'll get such widely different answers. For example, people who live in the Twin Cities versus people from greater Minnesota. There's people who have come from such towns where they say, oh, I'm from Austin, Minnesota. Is 50% of Minnesota Latino? And I will crack up and I say, I wish. But we're about 6% of the statewide population. But in the last 20, 30 years, almost all of that growth has happened in southern Minnesota and western Minnesota, in very specific communities and towns. It's grown around food processing. And sometimes you look at the data and you realize there's a bunch of people that are invisible because they work night jobs, they go to specific places where the community speaks Spanish, and you might not even know your town has changed in the last 20 years. It's 20%, 30% Latino, and you might not be connected with your new neighbors. So it really is 6% is a lot of people, and there's a role for this. But there's also Minnesota as a state of immigrants. It's been from the beginning. It was European immigrants, Nordic immigrants, many different communities. Now it's, you know, it was the Hmong and the Somali. And there's so many East African immigrants right now as well. And this is a state that needs to accommodate for a lot of diversity that it has.
One of the things that's kind of exciting is we're sitting here at your offices here on Lake Street, and we're sitting in you have a radio station. We're sitting in the studio for that.
Yes.
I'm really interested in that. Tell me a little bit about the radio outreach that you're doing and that kind of how that fits into your organizing.
First and foremost, in a state like Minnesota, there's not a lot of investment from the state or from medias in like Spanish language content. And so we felt a need to have accurate information for our community that was available in both Spanish and English. And then there's this radio station in California called Radio Jornalera. And what they do is they specifically have this station that is meant for what's called jornaleros, which are day laborers. And they're the kind of people that you see them outside of Home Depot or Menards, and they're ready to take gig jobs day by day. And they had developed this radio as an organizing tool to connect those workers with each other, connect them with up-to-date information, to talk about rights. And we worked with Radio Jornalera to build the Minnesota version and branch of the network. And so we do that for Minnesota. We bring on guests. We have Know Your Rights conversations. We invite on lawyers. We invite partners. I mean, we could do one with LSP, and we have translators and make conversations bilingual as well.
Do you have a rough idea of how many folks you engage with regularly, how many folks you're connecting with and organizing around, that kind of thing?
Yeah. We have a supporter and service network of around 40 or 50,000 people that engage with us. It's hundreds of people per day. I mean, we have our worker center, which has services in Minneapolis, but also in Rochester and Mankato. And every day people are just walking in, and we bridge the gap of both having resources and doing this campaign work. So we bring people in, they want a citizenship class, a language class, a computer class, and then we're saying, by the way, this is a law that we're working on changing. Can you be a part of that? And it's a really effective model.
Your regular initiatives that you work on kind of day in, day out are like you work around environmental justice, health and wellness organizing, developing leadership, and you have your worker center, that type of thing. So, like a lot of nonprofits, but I think particularly in the area that with the folks that you're working with the current administration, and frankly, it's war on immigration, for want of a better word, that must have caused you to pivot a little bit. I guess, can you just talk a little bit? I mean, we could go a deep dive into a lot of things right now. Can you talk a little bit how that maybe has caused you to maybe you have to focus more in an area that's almost stamping out a lot of fires, that type of thing?
It's a lot more defensive organizing. Copao was founded by people who were very active in the driver's licenses for all movement in Minnesota. And that effort was to restore a license to drive that was connected to immigration status in the early 2000s. And they said, now if you're an immigrant, you can no longer get a license. And that was such a big fight in Minnesota because Minnesota is a state where it's hard to get around without a car. Mm-hmm. It just is. And people had worked and pushed and pushed. And just a few years ago, we passed that as a transformational piece of legislation. And now our worker center is even a DVS testing location where you can go and get your permit to drive. So it's had a transformational impact. we were part of the North Star Promise Program, pushing for that law to make sure that immigrants and their kids who went to high school here are going to be living and working here could have the same access to college as everybody else. And now we're playing this defensive game where the administration is escalating their targeting of immigrants, but also targeting students more than ever before, targeting activists. And it's just it's a very difficult time to do the work, but it requires us to be really active and really responsive. We get reports from ICE's in Rochester. Families are being split apart. What do we do? And our organization is among the first to respond.
I guess the good news is you have that base of folks you've been organizing with, and then you're able to maybe tap into those connections when you really need it for something like, hey, we got to get some folks to talk about some of these issues and why immigration is important to the economy, that type of thing.
And we're a member-based organization like LSP. We have about 800 active members who renew annually. And we've actually learned a lot looking at LSP and looking at the model of membership and how impactful it is, and replicating or taking bits and pieces of the systems where it works for us. We don't have really powerful Latino membership organizations. In the Midwest, they're very few. And we have an opportunity to build something that is really uniquely powerful, especially the way we bridge these social services that people don't come and they don't say, oh, I want to go visit Copao because I really want to work on this cumulative impacts law and change house file, blah, blah, blah. They come to Copao because they have a real urgent need in their life. But then we're politicizing and we're working on these social issues. And I think there's a lot to learn from each other and a lot of power in these membership organizations.
I got to ask, it must be very difficult to organize in this kind of atmosphere of fear. That folks maybe are afraid to come out and speak and be in public even more so than ever.
There's more fear than ever, but at the same time, our community was always a target, and people think that what's happening now is new, and it's new in certain ways. Mm-hmm. What's new is that university students weren't considered fair game before. It's new to be targeting activists at this level. But, you know, if you were undocumented, you were always on the chopping block, and I think President Trump is still catching up with President Obama in terms of the net number of deportations and family separations. So under Democrats and Republicans alike, we've had problems where our community is easily sacrificed, and we need to continue to build organizing where people feel powerful and people speak up. And we let our members decide what risks they're going to take. We don't decide for them. We present the real information, but there's a lot of people who will say, go ahead, deport me. If I'm on my way out, I want to be powerful and be vocal and make change. So we can't decide that for anybody. Everybody has to do their own risk calculation. If you're a mother and you have kids here, your calculation is probably very different than if you're single and you have skills that you could bring back home or you could do in any country. And so there's just different risks. People that are afraid of if they return to their home country, they're going to be a target of violence. So there's a lot of reason people migrate here. But people take risks. People take risks because it is this much of a crisis. Even with driver's licenses for all, we had a moment. It was a January. It was freezing. It was the first day of session, and there was a blizzard. And the blizzard was keeping even, like, the families who wanted to visit the legislators and watch their swearing-ins. They were like, we'll skip it. We'll watch you online. But we had our day at the Capitol, the first day of session. We brought 70 people who drove, some of them from Worthington, Minnesota, from far corners of the state, who drove during this blizzard. And they said, no, we're taking that risk because this is a life or death issue that we're fighting for. And when people understand how grave the issue is, they're willing to take risks and they're willing to push the envelope. And that's the power of a lot of our members.
Everybody is coming at it from a different perspective, and there's different ways to show leadership, I guess. It's not just the classic model of being in front of the room and whatever, but there's different ways people can show leadership around different issues like this.
We have hundreds and hundreds of, like, posters, immigrant rights posters. There's some young people that are international students that are just saying, the only thing I feel comfortable with is getting these posters up, but I'm going to go down the block and talk to every business and get them to put that poster up. We have people who are writing and telling their stories under pseudonyms. We have people who are out on the streets and are on the bridge protesting visibly. And so it's different levels of leadership, different ways, and there's so many different ways to engage.
One of the ways LSP has been connected to COPAL is you used to be an organizer with the Land Stewardship Project. So, and you know, it's always fun to watch you watch people go on and do great things. And it's like, oh, yeah, I knew him back when. Anyway, that's a whole other story. But one of the areas more recently is LSP is part of this Immigrant Defense Network. Can you talk a little bit about that? It's kind of impressive, actually, how many members we have in a pretty short amount of time, from what I can see. That's a coalition that you're trying to pull together to really trying to reach out beyond COPAL and some of these other groups that might be only working with Latino or immigrant communities, but trying to bring in that big picture and say, hey, this affects a lot of more than just immigrant communities and folks like that.
After the election, for a couple weeks, many organizations reached out to COPAL and said, we know this period upcoming is going to be really difficult for immigrants. And they said, you guys lead and we'll follow and we'll support. But we have our principles, our JEMES principles, which say this is about building relationships of solidarity and mutuality, which means we can't have one person leading and everyone else following. We need to work hand in hand on solutions. One of those people actually, Sean Carroll from LSP, Sean came up and visited COPAL's office and said, we know this is dire. LSP has a lot of connections, relationships, power. What can we do to stand with you all? And that was very moving. And it really led me to think, well, what do we do about all these groups reaching out? There needs to be something that is a bigger response. And we called for a meeting, and about 30 organizations, 50 individuals showed up on the first meeting. And it was just like an hour and 10 minutes. But we already decided, look, there's like five or six core areas of coordination. Communities need a social service response. When someone is ripped from their families, often it's a dad who's a primary breadwinner for the family, and the family is left without income. It could be the U.S. citizen kid. It could be the partner may or may not have status, and these families are left without financial resources and support. There's a social service need. There's a legal need, which is representing in court, in immigration court, the people who are detained, who have been increasingly people without any criminal records. They're eligible for an immigration bond, but without proper representation, they might not actually know they can even petition for that, let alone win it with a high degree of success. There's a need for a policy response that's coordinated. There's a specific need to build connections and networks in greater Minnesota so that response is fast when they come to places like Rochester, Mankato, Austin, that there are community responses. So there's all these areas of need. Joint narrative is another big one, like telling positive stories about immigrants who are in every sector of our society and do amazing and great things when the public is turned against them. So there's a lot of coordination, and we've now arrived at over 90 organizations coordinating. Wow. We're in the process of forming a steering committee, and LSP has been a part of that circle of conversations. And we really need to formalize this and to know that it's not just Trump administration thing, mm-hmm. that immigrants always need defense and protecting, and there will always be this work to do going beyond whatever administration we end up in.
Frankly, we do get questions about why is the Land Stewardship Project involved with issues like immigrant rights, that kind of thing. And, you know, the general answer we give is, well, we won't have a truly sustainable regenerative agriculture until it's sustainable and regenerative for everybody. And that includes the food system, anybody involved with the food system, that type of thing. However, I think another thing that helps maybe people realize why it's important for in an organization that's mostly worked on agriculture in the past to be involved with this issue is the history here, which I think for a lot of people may be a little surprising. We have a pretty short attention span here in America when it comes to history, to put it nicely, especially in a state like Minnesota. People might think the immigration issue, the controversy around immigration, and the immigrant story in general is a recent thing. People talk about if they come from their family comes from Scandinavia. Somehow they seem to picture that differently than they this. I'm not sure. I don't know. I want to go into that right now. But you really, I think I've heard you describe this before. You give a really nice description of the history of immigration and the connection to agriculture here in Minnesota. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, and there's both a national history and a uniquely Minnesota history as well. And the national history is that we as a country relied on enslaved African labor to power our agricultural system. And when that was outlawed, it was replaced with immigrant labor. And the way it was replaced was corporations and big farmers would go to Mexico in specific and to states along the border of Mexico, recruit workers, put them on a caravan and bring them to whatever agricultural site needed their labor. And that's the big picture. In Minnesota, it looked a little bit like this. In the 20s, we had a first big wave of folks, which was the betabeleros. Those are the sugar beet workers. And the sugar beets across the Red River Valley and across parts of the upper Midwest, that sugar beet operation relied on immigrant labor. And that's why they were called the beet workers, the betabeleros. And that actually formed the history of where Latinos are in Minnesota, because those beet workers seasonally would be working on farms across the state. But then actually, during the winters, they would settle in the west side of St. Paul, West St. Paul, Inver Grove Heights, and they formed what is now, you know, the first Latino barrio of the state of Minnesota, which is the west side. And so they were between, you know, between places working. Followed by that, it was formalized across the U.S. as the Bracero program. The Bracero program from the 1940s to the 1960s was this work program that was for Mexicans to basically come to the U.S., do seasonal farm work, come back, be between the two countries. And that whole model was because it's cheaper to have immigrant labor. It's more affordable. And white Americans didn't want to do a lot of those jobs. And so the Bracero program is one that brings a lot of pride. There's a lot of Latinos descended from Braceros. But it also was unfair conditions, lower pay, insufficient wages, right? Like, those were impactful and had a lot of negative impacts on the community as well. That immigrant labor was happening across the country. It was happening specifically in Minnesota. It's been in southern Minnesota, especially, but it's been powering a lot of agriculture. And in the 1950s was this first major round of immigrant backlash. And it was the Eisenhower administration. They started doing mass deportations. They started targeting people, including naturalized citizens, bringing them back over the border. And a big part of the reason they did that was because white U.S. farmers were saying, we need this labor to be ours. We cannot have others doing this work. It needs to be American labor. What they figured out really quickly is that white Americans didn't want to do those jobs. And as a result of that, it actually accelerated the mechanization of farms, because they said, okay, well, we can't do this, so how can a machine make this more effective? And the last thing I want to name is the farm workers movement. In the 1960s and 1970s, the United Farm Workers organized, based out of California. It was Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta, and Larry Leong. They organized strikes, boycotts, and they improved the economic systems that underpin our agriculture. Now, how does this return to Minnesota? Because we talked about the beet workers. Today, Minnesota is a place totally dependent on immigrant labor. The food processing system is totally dependent. It's not just, I mean, in the kitchens, yes, in the places that you sometimes we think about, immigrants are underpinning that. But they are underpinning agriculture. And even though I say 6% Latino, there's still huge seasonal workforces that come to Minnesota during very specific times and weeks of the year and leave to go back to whatever other state. In Minnesota in 2006, another wave of anti-immigration was striking the country, and what happened was called Operation Wagon Train. And during Operation Wagon Train, ICE targeted processing plants owned by Swift and Company, which included in Iowa, Nebraska, Texas, Colorado, and Utah, but included was Minnesota, Worthington. And actually, that raid in Worthington is among the largest immigration raids in U.S. history. Wow. And I have friends who they lost loved ones to that raid and never seen them again. It is like a crisis moment for the immigrant rights movement. And it happened here in Minnesota in Worthington. It was literally hundreds of people detained and deported out. It was, there's organizers who, they were the ones, they were carrying the babies that whose parents were detained and deported and split from them. And it was just such a traumatic thing. And now when we see what's happening now, it's an echo of what the Eisenhower administration did. It's an echo of 2006. And we have a moment here where we have to push back once again.
I think that's a really good point, that it's the history of immigration is not new. I mean, history repeats itself, but also the crackdowns. And it seems to run in cycles that when people are looking for a bad guy, some element to blame for their problems, immigrants are a real easy target. And so it seems to kind of, we particularly see that in agriculture and when the economy crashes, instead of looking at, well, what's the role that corporate consolidation's playing or certain government policies, they go for the real in, and the corporations are, and the government are willing to take advantage of that too, I think.
I remember one time a few years ago, I was looking at a map of what's called sanctuary cities, and that doesn't have a really good legal definition, but basically a sanctuary is a place where they're not going to cooperate intentionally and do the work of ICE for them, because a state or a city can't control what the federal government does, but it doesn't have to help them either. And I was looking at this map, and I was like, why are there so many towns and cities in Iowa and these other red states, Republican states, that have become sanctuaries? And I was so confused. And then I realized, oh, it's because companies actually want their workers protected because they need a stable supply of labor, and it's economically beneficial for immigrants to be protected. And it was just an eye-opening moment of, this often is not a left-right issue. It's not a Democrats and Republicans issue. It's who is it in the best interest of to protect immigrants. And right now, it's a really weird moment because people are saying, we want the economy to improve. We want to lower the cost of goods. And yet, all of those things are tied to immigration and immigrant labor. And Minnesota is a place where, in the last 20 years, the population of Minnesota would have declined if it weren't for immigrant labor, if it weren't for immigrants coming here to study, to take jobs, and to be part of our society. And the Chamber of Commerce in Minnesota issued a whole report in February about, wow, our whole state would be collapsing without immigrants right now, and how we need more immigrants in order to be able to sustain what we have, let alone grow and create more wealth for the state. So it is just a really interesting time where you see these patterns of the system acknowledging that that's a good investment to have immigrants, and then the system turning its back and saying, we need someone to blame for whatever's happening in the economy or politics.
Right.
When we don't want to romanticize immigrant labor in the food and farm system. It's difficult. There's a lot of injustice. But it is a cornerstone right now,
right,
and it is something that can be improved and given dignity and given fairness rather than, you know, hanging deportations over people's heads and separating families.
This is a message we try to get across to the farmers we work with, particularly if they're raising hogs or beef cattle or even in the dairy industry, in that there are very similar enemies out there that they aren't maybe recognizing, that the big corporate consolidation system that's profit above all else is a common opponent that we should be focusing on rather than falling into this trap of turning against each other a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I think we saw that particularly with NAFTA. There was like all of a sudden people weren't looking at trade policy. They were looking at, oh my gosh, we have all these people coming in because NAFTA gutted the farm economy in Mexico and, you know, areas like that.
They're really complex systems, but yeah, the enemy is the same. And the enemy is a system of greed. And a system of greed not only leverages immigrant labor because that can be valuable, but abuses it and abuses working conditions, abuses immigrants. It also abuses small farmers. And so what can we build that is dignified, healthy, and economically like wealthy and prosperous for farmers of all types, for farm workers of all types? It really should and can be a unified movement. I can imagine, you know, what it means to be an LSP member farm. And one of those things can be, we're going to pay contractors and contract labor fairly, and we're going to look at market rates, and we're going to give something that is equitable and fair. We're going to make sure if we house people that our housing conditions are healthy and safe. Those are all aspects of what it means to have stable communities. And the workforce is one thing, but the other side is the consumers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's first and second generation immigrants. It's their kids, too, is like, these are the consumers increasingly in small town communities are the new immigrants. If we start scaring people off, we're going to also just depress the economy. Like, people are not I mean, people already, they're scared to buy with inflation, with everything else happening. Mm-hmm. And how is that good for anyone's bottom line?
One other thing that strikes me, too, is, and we've seen this through our Farm Beginnings program, our Beginning Farmer Training program, we're seeing more and more people, Latinos, other people of color, new immigrants who are taking this course because, surprise, surprise, a lot of them come from an agrarian background.
Yeah.
And have that knowledge, some knowledge, and maybe they just need a brush up on how to maybe adapt that to the upper Midwest and the kind of climate we have here. I think that's an exciting area, and it's an example of looking at some of these folks, how they can maybe, if they want to, transition from being part of the food system as a worker into an entrepreneur type of thing.
Yeah, it was funny. I remember a conversation, a community member who, and they were a white person who said, oh, we need to teach the people of color to farm and we need to help them learn what farming is and what it's like. And I was so confused. I'm like, people of color, these people you're talking about are farmers. They come from agrarian backgrounds. Yeah. And I had a really eye-opening experience. We did a collaboration with LSP, I think last year in Austin at the Yovag Family Farm.
Yeah.
And I had a community or a team member, actually, who his name is David Perdomo. He's Salvadoran. He is based out of Rochester. And me and him were going to visit the farm together. And he had a very emotional moment looking at it. And it was really bringing tears to his eyes because he said, it was always my dream in El Salvador to have a farm.
Wow.
And have these animals and to take care of animals. And he's a pastor too, so he's for him, it's he literally wants to be a pastor and have his sheep as well. And he was so in joy. And he said, it was so interesting. He was telling me all the ways it's similar and different than back home. And I said, what's like the big difference? What do you see that's different? And he said, oh, way more land, way more land, way bigger farms. And I just laughed at that. But there's so many people that they were farming back home or they had a small plot or their family, they're descended from farmers and that's in their blood. And they come to places like Minnesota and there's not a clear pathway.
Mm-hmm.
But programs like Farm Beginnings really create that outline of, okay, how can I go through and learn this system and become a business owner and have my entrepreneurship and also do things differently. There's a really big project. I'm mean to meet with the LSP about this, but it relates to Gustavo Romero and his efforts at Nixta, which is a tortilleria. And he makes these tortillas and they use like these native cooking practices. But the other thing is they use different diverse corns.
Mm.
And they have this idea of, well, there could be a different corn for everything. Like the best corn for the tortilla is not the best corn for corn syrup or for whatever product, right?
Right.
And they're very about corn diversification, and it's such a fascinating thing. But that you only get that because they have that background in Mexico where there's dozens and dozens of actively used types of corn while they come here to a corn monoculture. So there's just really, it brings so much diversity to when people want to grow different things.
Mm-hmm.
They want to fit their practices into Minnesota. They want to learn, okay, what can we do similar or what's a similar crop or an alternative crop for our traditional recipes that could be grown here? And I think there's just so much potential to be unlocked.
What a concept, consuming food, corn as a human food. That's an interesting.
Right. Right, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You alluded to this a little bit before. You know, right now it's a lot of, you're on defense as far as a lot of the stuff you're doing, but let's remove that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Let's live in dream world where we're not having this, this crisis. I love fantasy. On a day-to-day basis, what are some of the main challenges the folks you work with face, but then also what are some of the opportunities that they face that you see out there that, you know, because they wouldn't be here if there wasn't opportunities and they wouldn't be getting up in the morning and like you said, standing up sometimes unless there were opportunities. But talk a little bit about that.
People outside of the U.S., so many people come here. I mean, they might be escaping something. They might be in fear. They might have so many challenges, but ultimately they still view this country as a place where there's an American dream. And the American dream is a dignified life. It's a house over your head. It's having your pets. It's having your car. It's all these things that it might actually sometimes seem like a really simple dream. And when they come here, it's how do I get that dream? How do I have safety, security, health and wellness? A pathway, sometimes the biggest thing is, actually, I don't care if I get those things, but my kids, should get those things. They should get an education. So people come here and we create, you know, pathways for that. And sometimes the challenge is, I don't know how to use a computer. And I'm a really smart person, but I don't know how to use a computer. What can I do? I don't have my citizenship class. I don't have a citizenship, and that's prohibiting me from certain things. Increasingly, there's a really big problem where people coming here to the U.S., because it's so hard to migrate right now, are highly educated people with a lot of skills. They come and they're actually, back home would be considered a very privileged person. They have so many resources and skills and talents, and they're the ones that can afford the really expensive cost of migrating. And that cost right now, I think someone told me, is it takes $40,000 to cross the border, which a lot of us don't have $40,000. No. But imagine if you're an immigrant in your country that is not on the U.S. dollar. That is an insane amount of money for right. you. And so people are coming and they're skilled back home as they're literally like scientists, chemists. They worked in government bureaucracy. They brought so many skills, but they come here and their degree is not considered valid. They might have be an electrician and their license isn't considered valid. And all the exams are in English and they may or may not speak English, but it's so complex to know where to get started, to have a business or to seek the next stage. So a lot of our work too is uncovering why those systems are sometimes needlessly complicated and not helpful, and figuring out what needs to change. And for example, to be an electrician, do you need to be fluent in English? Probably not. You need to know some terminology. Yeah. You need to be able to read certain things, but you probably don't need a high level of English fluency. Can you take the test in Spanish? Can you demonstrate knowledge of enough English to do the job? I don't know. So we figure out what are the barriers in these very complex systems that people can navigate to build wealth, to have healthy, dignified lives.
I actually just ran into a woman. I can't think what country she was from, but she was a veterinarian in her home country. So, you know, talk about a skill that takes a lot of education and is a very valuable skill in rural areas right now. We were short on veterinarians. So.
Veterinarians, people have a lot of nursing skills that they were basically healers in their home countries, but that doesn't translate to like just being recognized as a nurse here. People have so many skills that they arrive with, and we need to honor those and create pathways.
You hinted at this a little bit before, but for a white rural resident, a farmer, or just a rural resident in general, what are some, even if they have the best intentions, it's a little overwhelming right now. Like I said, we're in a crisis moment, but kind of in general, related to that crisis, but also related to how we go forward in the long term and create a better situation for new immigrants and that kind of thing. I mean, what's I don't want like, okay, there's three things you can do, but you know, what are some things could be some things that people could prioritize as we go into the future here? Cause we got to get past this crisis moment, and we will, I think. You thought about that?
Yeah, I have one thing that people can do.
Oh, okay.
And it's super simple, and it's know your neighbors. I had an ally person who had the best intentions who came up and said, oh, I love these red cards. And red cards is a term for these. They're literally red little cards, but they have know your rights information. Mm-hmm. And they have don't open the door. You need a warrant, blah, 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 blah. And she said, there's a Latino family on my block. Should I go and give this to them? And I thought for a second and I asked, have you ever met this family? And she gave me a look and she was like, no. I said, have you ever said hello or talked to this family? No. So how about this? They might not even need the red card. They could all be citizens. And, but can you start by talking to them, introducing yourself? Mm-hmm. And this, on top of it, this person spoke Spanish. And I'm like, you speak Spanish. Oh. You can have a conversation. But even if you didn't, like, people have a basic conversation, like, introduce yourself, know your neighbors. And what is specific to small towns is in the last 20 years, I mean, the Twin Cities has been a diverse place for a long time. But in Minnesota, the small towns have diversified in the last 20 years. Oh. And there's a lot of people in your town. You might live in two different realities. I was in Melrose outside of St. Cloud, and we chose Melrose for a door knocking because Melrose is one of those places that has just diversified so much, has a huge Latino population now. And we were talking with white neighbors and Latino neighbors, and everybody, one thing they were saying is, we want more opportunities to connect with the others in our community. And the others for them was the Latinos who said, we are more comfortable with Spanish, but we still want to meet more of the English-speaking community. And the English speakers who said, there's one guy, he said, my neighbors next door, I don't really know them well, but they cook good food and I smell it. And I said, that's great. As a connection. So it's like, let's have more community spaces. And those are uncomfortable sometimes, mm-hmm. especially when there's a language barrier potentially. But be uncomfortable and get to know people and don't be a stranger. And everything about our society is going to improve. All of this is because people don't know each other and people don't honor each other's lived experiences. But if you just know your people around you, you're going to be in a better place as a community.
For more on COPAL and the work LSP is doing related to issues such as immigrant rights, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 373 at landstewardshipproject.org. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendell, a Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.